This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. The Human Development Report 2020 that was released by the United Nations Development Programme lays out a stark choice for world leaders. Take bold steps to reduce the immense pressure that is being exerted on the environment and the natural world, or humanity's progress will stall. The report indicated that no country in the world has yet achieved very high human development without putting immense strain on the planet. So joining me to discuss the report in full and why the next frontier for human development will require working with and not against nature is Niloy Banerjee, UNDP's resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam. Welcome, Niloy. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you, Juliet. And very nice to be back on the show.
Yes, lovely to have you back on the show. Well, Happy New Year to you too as well. 2020 was a tough year. I hope you're, you know, facing 2021 with some renewed hope as well, like the rest of us.
Absolutely. Looking forward to a much better year, and to you and all colleagues at BFM also, warm wishes.
Thank you so much. So, just looking straight at the report, this is the 30th anniversary edition of UNDP's Human Development Report. Before we get into it, can you just remind people what this report is all about and what it is that it actually analyzes?
Sure. You know, the Human Development Report is basically a publication of the human development standing of nations, where they rank on a league table, if you like, year on year. We've been doing this for 30 years now. And the idea of what we mean by human development is it's really a composite capture index of life going beyond GDP. Traditionally, as you know, gross domestic product or national income is counted as an indicator and measure of progress and well-being of a nation. So UNDP started the human development concept as a counter to that, that it's not all about income. It's about the quality of life and freedoms and choices, mm-hmm. and what you can do or not do, and the values that underpin such, which essentially formed a human development concept, which is then underpinned by a mathematical calculation of how that is arrived at. So this year's report is really looking at how human development interacts with the planet and how we may be fast reaching a situation where, for the first time ever in human history, but also planetary history, mm-hmm. One species is shaping the planet rather than the planet shaping species. So it's an epochal moment. Yeah. And therefore, we have decided to call it the Age of Humans.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is what the edition is titled, right? The Next Frontier, Human Development and the Anthropocene. And this report, I understand, brings up the notion of the Anthropocene as the new era of defining human development. Maybe, you know, for those of us who aren't quite familiar with that term, can you shed more light on the Anthropocene and how it's actually relevant to human development?
So it's a term taken from the geological sciences. As you know, the history of the Earth is broken up into these periods, epochs.
That's right, yeah.
Geological periods. And it is a growing consensus among scientists, although there are still outliers, that we have now entered for the first time, after 12,000 years of the last epoch, mm-hmm. The Holocene, we are now probably entering a phase where it's the age of humans, and because the impact of humans is so significant. So that's where the term is coming from. It's by no means a fully consensual picture among the scientific, mm-hmm. among geologists, but it's increasingly gaining traction that human beings are now beginning to shape the planet more than ever before. And for the first time, the balance is tipping away from the planet towards human beings. And that has consequences.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I understand that something new about this particular edition is that it includes a new experimental index on human progress that takes into account countries' carbon dioxide emissions and even their material footprint, right? And why has this index been adjusted as such?
So it's The idea is to look at human development and how countries have progressed over the years on human development, on the human development scale, if you like. Mm-hmm. But then if you adjust for how they have done for carbon dioxide emissions or how they have done for material footprint, which is basically the net amount of extraction that the, that a country does, then we look for, well, what happens when you adjust for these two parameters? And then we call it the planetary pressures adjusted human development index and how the picture changes. The most stark realization of that is, of course, that almost no country has achieved high human development while at the same time keeping a small planetary footprint. So we have work to do if we are to imagine our futures in a more sustainable way. Then there is clearly work to be done. We cannot have this, you know, the cost of high development is at the expense of the planet, which is what it comes out to be.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to many environmentalists before on the job, and one in particular, Richard Heinberg, who's from the US for Post Carbon Institute. And I mean, one of the things that he was at the forefront of telling the world about was you can't go on doing things infinitely on a planet that, you know, only has finite resources, right? And that is pretty much the kind of situation that we are in right now. We are just acting like we have resources that will continue till the end of, I mean, I don't know, till the end of time, I suppose.
Exactly. And therefore, it's really trying to see the interplay of social, environmental, economic, human interactions and reimagining how we go forward from here. Because as you say, it's not just the scale at which we are approaching unsustainability, it's also the speed at which we are doing it. We are doing it faster and faster. So we are getting to an unfeasible future at a faster rate.
And it's terrifying. I mean, look what we've done.
Exactly. This year is the year to speak about it because it's right in our face.
Exactly. I mean, 2020 has exposed, you know, all the prevailing challenges across the globe. Of course, the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, it's also exacerbated inequalities, hasn't it? And I guess, you know, would you say that now more than ever, we must consider development in a different way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You remember when we last spoke, we talked about the new frontier of inequality, which
That's
was
right.
digital inequalities. And during the pandemic, we saw that. Mm-hmm. Those who were on the digital highway with infrastructure, with adequate space at home, with on broadband, they barely batted an eyelid and adjusted.
Yeah.
Those who weren't. You know, where children shared rooms with adults and there was no place to do academic work. There was no, there were no spare laptops or computers for each person in the family. There's been a massive slide back. So there you are. I mean, and in the same conversation we had spoken, that climate change is the next frontier for creating inequalities. And it is, it's now coming there with the impacts of climate change being felt most by the poor and the vulnerable, including poorer countries, but also poorer people.
Yeah, and just looking at this year's report, what sort of picture has been painted with the resulting planetary pressures adjusted HDI, or the PHDI, right? Is it a clearer assessment of human progress, would you say?
It's a more sobering assessment of human progress. It's, it's you know, countries which have done traditionally well on the HDI, including, you know, in our own region, certainly Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei. When you apply the planetary filter to these three countries, their rankings change significantly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sobering. And we are not trying to, of course, create a naming and shaming or a blame game here, but because, you know, who's responsible is a whole different question. But we are trying to create, open the conversation that when you apply a planetary filter, what seemed a fairly rosy picture for some countries is actually not quite so rosy. And then when some countries which are not doing so well on the Human Development Index, they have much smaller range of change, if you like. In fact, in the ASEAN region, Most countries actually gain in the league table except Malaysia, Singapore, and Brunei. So that's a sobering picture for sure.
Okay, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that after this quick break. I'm speaking today to Niloy Banerjee. He is the resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam for the UNDP or the United Nations Development Programme. And we're discussing the Human Development Report of 2020. We're discussing whether the planet and people are on a collision course. And we're going to continue that discussion after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today is Niloy Banerjee. He is the resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam for the United Nations Development Programme. And we're discussing the outcomes of the or the findings from the Human Development Report 2020. And that report this year is titled The Next Frontier, Human Development and the Anthropocene. And it brings up the notion that the Anthropocene is the new era of defining human development. So just kind of looking at the report, Niloy, UNDP has come out to say that progress in human development, and I'm quoting here, will require working with and not against nature while transforming social norms, values, and government financial incentives. That's a lot there. That's a lot to unpack. What does that look like in reality?
Well, the underpinning logic behind that statement is really there's no point thinking silver bullet solutions, like one track solutions. You cannot solve for employment and livelihoods in isolation from the environment, or you cannot solve for social cohesion in isolation of how the GDP, how the economy is faring. Mm. So it's really first to say that there is an interconnected set of solutions. So there is no single bullet, and that's we make that very clear in the report that we are not trying to prescribe solutions, but solutions lie at the intersection of policies, of the economy, of social and behavioral change, of what kind of taxes, punishments, and incentives the government gives out, how institutions behave and how governance is conducted, are all interconnected in seeking solutions. So if you, for example, illustrate with the case of Malaysia, the carbon footprint, that is CO2 emissions per capita, is highest in the region bar Brunei. So the use of fossil fuels in Malaysia is the highest in the region bar Brunei again. So the use of fossil fuels is an institutional and policy solution. The use of carbon CO2, the high per capita CO2 emissions reduction in that is not just a policy solution. It's also about how we behave, which gets into the social and what choices we make and how we change our consumption or production or transportation patterns. Mm. So it's and then what kind of incentives are out there to encourage this behavior and how. So we are actually talking about solutions in three different domains, which I'll come to later in our conversation.
Okay. All right. And I guess, what I'm getting from this is that it's really time for us to relax our reliance on natural resources. And, those are ways that we can ensure better resilience, to the future crisis. I mean, this crisis took us by surprise. If we don't learn any lessons from it, I mean, what's to become of us really, right?
Exactly. And again, as you saw in this crisis, it wasn't there's no single solution. It started as a zoonotic as a disease that jumped into from one species to another, and suddenly the next thing you know, it was impacting livelihoods, it was impacting travel, it was impacting how families could celebrate or not weddings and festivals or commiserate during bereavements. So again, it just goes to show the interconnectedness of and then the difficult choices that policymakers had to make, because would you stop people from going to work or would you rather keep people safe and put in movement control orders as we saw here, and both have consequences and both have a price to pay. So again, the interplay of multiple complexities is very clear, and that's where we need to seek our new frontier solutions and think differently, really.
Yeah, thinking differently is the important thing, right? Because I know in the report it stated that agency, you know, and that's of course the ability to make one's desired choices, and also values, which is the choices that are the most desired. Those are the critical dimensions of human development, right? What exact roles would you say they play within the context of human development?
Well, values and agency combine to make all of us choose what we choose to do and what we choose to not do. So the wearing of masks, as you know, most of us quickly adopted to a new value, a new norm, I'm sorry, that we wear masks because it protects us as individuals, but it protects also people who we interact with and our loved ones.
That's right.
Now, not everybody got on this bandwagon quickly because, I don't care, or, you know, my politics doesn't allow it, or this, that, and the other. But by and large, it was a fairly short period within which people adjusted to a new social norm. As opposed to, let's take another example, growing up as a child, there were no seatbelts in cars. I mean, wearing a seatbelt was not a social norm. It wasn't part of social behavior.
Mm.
Whereas now it's impossible to think of that. But in that period, it took, let's say, 30, 35 years for that shift to happen, that shift in norms based on values to happen. Whereas now, because we are interacting destructively with the planet faster and faster, we need these shifts to happen much sooner. And that's what the anecdote about the masks should illustrate. We quickly adopted to wearing masks, and it's now almost the other fashion accessory.
The fashion accessory of 2020.
It's so widespread, exactly. So that's where values come in, and you know, how we consume and how we commute, how we and therefore what choices we make and what choices we are capable of making. These factors come in quite quickly to create the composite of how the choices and the behaviors that we will demonstrate as in relation to the planet.
Okay. All right. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that the report was kind of structured to go into three different prongs, right? So one was renewing human development for the Anthropocene. The second was mechanisms of change to catalyze action. And finally, exploring new metrics. Maybe you can help walk us through, you know, each of those different umbrellas of discussion.
Sure. I mean, the first domain is really laying out the problem. What exactly is happening, which is, we are impacting the planet. And as I said at the beginning, it's the first time a species is impacting the planet rather than the other way. A species is shaping the planet rather than the other way around. If so, there are huge consequences. There are, of course, what you would call human progress has been tremendous, but the consequences are getting bigger and bigger. So at this year, 2020, with the pandemic right in our, blowing up in our face, that proposition needs no further illustration. But it also masked, you know, because the pandemic was the elephant in the room, it masked some other big disasters that happened in 2020. And the Australian forest fires mm-hmm. and the Brazilian forest fires, mm-hmm. the record number of storms in the Atlantic. So these are all things are speeding up, and if COVID is probably the fourth now disease in the last 20 years, which has jumped from an animal species to a human species. Now this is, again, you can see it's speeding up. So this is our first proposition, the first domain, if you like, that human beings are having an impact, and we need to do something about it. We need to recognize it and do something.
Mm-hmm.
The second domain is, okay, where are our domains of action? We say that first we must look at nature-based solutions more and more. And I can unpack that a little later in the conversation. Our second domain is that we need to really, really look at incentives and regulations, because we have not done enough in that front to look at which incentives are creating perverse behavior. If you make fossil fuels cheap, then people will use fossil fuels. It's as simple as that. So And the flip side of that is what regulations, what carrots and sticks do you really need to use to manage behavior? And the third domain of action really is what we spoke about just now, the social norms and values. You know, how we socialize children to have a constructive engagement with the planet, how we change our own consumption and behavior patterns, how we change our production patterns, how we value different things than we may be currently valuing now. So that's sort of the second bucket that we're talking about. And then putting some metrics is really this new index that we've created, where you look at the Human Development Index, you look at the rankings of countries on the index, and then you put a planetary filter on it and say, well, are these high performing or countries doing really well when you put a planetary filter on it? So and taking it beyond anecdote and stories to actually some hard numbers. But again, as a conversation starter, as a reflection space, not as a not as something that we have a definite solution for.
Okay, and I guess, you know, what do you want people to take from this report? You know, I mean, it's mentioned that there's a gap between, let's say, people's values and their behavior, right? And that incentives is one of the most effective methods in helping to bridge that gap by changing people's behavior. How do you know? That's always I find the hardest thing, right? Changing mindsets, getting people to change. Maybe you can briefly explain why this is the case, and maybe provide some examples in which people are able to change their behavior as a result of incentives.
Well, the best example is how we have gotten addicted to fossil fuels. It's because the world cumulatively gives out about $5 trillion of fossil fuel subsidies.
That's right.
Nowhere more acutely than in countries which particularly are producers and net exporters of fossil fuels, like Malaysia. I think we've spoken in the past that gas is cheaper in Malaysia than almost anywhere in the Asia Pacific.
Yes, we have, yeah.
So that's subsidized fossil fuel. Now, if you do, it's almost natural human behavior that if you give out fossil fuel cheap, everything will evolve to respond to that. Production of vehicles, etc., will evolve to respond to that. People's consumption behavior, how many cars they purchase or how they commute, will be influenced by how cheap or expensive fossil gas is. And I can drag this analogy out for everything. If you electricity or anything in the circular economy, if it's cheap to throw away plastic bottles, then you would do that, as opposed to if there's a serious tax or a serious disincentive throwing away plastic bottles after one use, you know. So if you move to a use and reuse mindset, as opposed to it needs incentives and punishments or sanctions to manage those behaviors. So that's one. And the second, the normative change is really what we value and how we educate ourselves. So it's the seatbelt example I was giving you earlier is exactly a manifestation of that. Whether at one point in time it wasn't considered essential, or the need for safety was not valued as much as it evolved to be eventually, and therefore seatbelts became a compulsory feature, and you had to wear seatbelts compulsorily. And and if you didn't, there were punishments for it. There were sanctions against it. So there you are. That's the complex interplay of incentives and sanctions and how regulations can come in to design this system of incentives and sanctions.
Okay. Yeah. And speaking of making changes, right, it's also indicated that, and something that you alluded to earlier as well, that nature-based human development and nature-based solutions, those are also going to be some of the main mechanisms of change. Talk to me a little bit about that. You know, what exactly are nature-based solutions and how can it actually help?
Let me talk from UNDP's experience. I mean, first, we have to value biodiversity. Species are disappearing at an alarming rate. 70% of species have disappeared since the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. So we have to put a fair price on carbon. We cannot keep carbon prices at where they are with such huge subsidies.
Right.
We have to look at the emissions of greenhouse gases. And that really means how we construct our buildings, how we transport ourselves, how infrastructure works, how we grow our food. That's a whole segment of, there's a whole nature-based solutions package to be had there. Mm. And then the circular economy that I talked about earlier, Juliet, that this whole culture of use and throw, and you know, ironically, we find that countries at the lower end of the human development spectrum are actually better users of circularity, because there is a culture of reusing stuff because things are, you know, because incomes are lower and affordability is lower. Therefore, people tend to use and reuse stuff much more than people in more high-income, high human development countries.
Mm.
And the final one, I'm not trying to do an exhaustive list, but another one that's really important is protecting traditional cultures and indigenous communities and their cultures and their knowledge systems. Again, because they have a very positive dependency with nature instead of a destructive dependency. So... yeah, I would, but there are many more nature-based solutions that we can talk about.
Yeah, that's a whole different conversation right there, isn't it? But, you know, just still on nature-based solutions, right? I mean, the report did also imply that there are some challenges faced by it, despite its huge potential in realizing substantial benefits, as governments are the primary proponents, which could help marshal collective action and make actual changes. So do you think it's essential for governments to not just be aware of it, but also literate in these nature-based solutions so that they can actually start to help facilitate social mobilization from the bottom up more effectively?
Yeah, governments have a role, certainly, because it's the biggest actor in the room on shifting the paradigm of our economies and societies from unsustainable consumption and production to a more sustainable pathway. And therefore, I would say a very large proportion of action emanates from the government policy, regulations, incentives, all that we talked about.
Yeah.
But the values and norms part, I think, resides more with us, with society, with individuals. How parents socialize their children and what responsibilities are inculcated. How we then model our own behaviors to show those responsibilities. So it's a combination, I would say, of government and social action in a collective way. And then, of course, there is a whole governance issue, how our parliaments function, how our ministries and departments function, and what kind of debates and rules and regulations they bring into play is of course, very, very important. So, yeah, to the bottom up definitely comes from a combination of government and our own behavior, human behavior.
Okay, all right. And I failed to ask you about Malaysia's HDI value and rank in this year's report. So just correct me if I'm wrong, these stats actually depict the state of human development before the COVID-19 pandemic, yes?
That's correct. Actually, I should have mentioned that the data used in this report is 2019 data before the pandemic. So the picture is a lot more rosy than it'll look in next year's report.
Oh dear.
In fact, in the report, we also allude to something that we had said earlier in the summer, that this has been the most dramatic backslide in human development since we started measuring it in 1990. So yes, this is figures for 2019 that we're talking about.
Okay. And I mean, you did kind of mention briefly Malaysia's value and rank. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to you know, Malaysia's sort of where we are in the rankings this year?
On the traditional human development index, Malaysia's done almost exactly as well as it had done the year before. So it's actually improved one rank to 62. But that hides some major issues that need to be talked about and discussed. We've talked quite a bit about the carbon emission and fossil fuel dependence, but let me maybe highlight another one which hasn't changed much since last year. Malaysia's tremendous difference between male gender difference in income, male incomes and female incomes is for comparable countries, it's quite a stark difference. I mean, no other country in ASEAN compares. Indonesia comes close, but even there, it's not as the difference in incomes between male and female is just quite striking, and which creates a whole new inequality that needs to be addressed. The conversation definitely needs to begin because it's looking like that's a chronic problem. It's not going to go away again unless social norms, values come together with governmental incentives, regulations, and directed policy. So it's this cannot just keep continuing.
And the gender, I mean, there's a gender inequality index, right? And I think there's a lot of places where we're not doing so great. I mean, it's measured by the share of parliamentary, how is it measured actually? And, you know, how do we stand in other areas besides the wage gap?
Well, it's got a number of parameters. How many seats in parliament are women? What percentage of parliamentary seats are held by women? Which is where, again, we're not the shining city on the hill.
I'll say it for you, Niloy. It's dismal.
it could certainly improve. But on others like life expectancy and maternal mortality, it's much better. So it's again not a straightforward picture, but you know where the pressure points are, where you can make a difference. And the COVID has, by the way, brought out another dimension, the double burden even working from home, but then having to educate children, having to do the cooking, and then also being a professional working from home. It's just been an amazing set of odds that women have faced. And sorry, not to forget violence against women, domestic abuse increased massively during the COVID lockdown period. So another area where some improvement is definitely called for.
Yeah, and I just have to say this, the moment you were talking about work from home challenges and, you know, the double burden of women, both my children who I had to bring to the office today happened to walk past the studio and wave at me. It's almost as if they could hear you. Oh, dear me. Yes, it's been a pretty stressful year. But, you know, there's a lot of findings here. There's so much that, you know, the report offers. How do you take these findings and work, especially with local communities? You know, do you find local partners to consult or to analyze and develop plans that would meet all these different local needs, especially?
Yeah, that is classic UNDP's classical operating model. The Human Development Report and all our research and policy work are essentially, as I said before, conversation starters and reflection spaces. From there, we take it to what is UNDP's bread and butter, which is a more formal sort of programming process where we come in, do the analytical work, find points of intervention, do the consultations with communities and stakeholders, government most of all, but also CSOs, and then design interventions which sort of follow this whole logic of how we take it from an idea to action and then actually capture and measure results and then maybe talk a little bit about what results we've come up with.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, to just kind of bring it all together, taking into account everything that the study has found, how do we react to this new age that we find ourselves in? You know, I think, of course, what UNDP is suggesting is to strike out on bold new paths, striving to continue human development while easing planetary pressures, right? So tell me about that. You know, how can we do that? How can we achieve that?
My crystal ball, where is it?
How can we start it then? How can we start?
Yes, change begins with the self. We've talked a lot about changing our norms, changing our behaviors, instilling the right values in our children. But also our work with governments, how we engage governments and what we, how we dialogue with governments and how we bring the sensitization that needs to come. And governments are not monolithic, monochromatic structures. They also struggle with trade-offs. They did during the COVID crisis, of choosing one option over another and facing the consequences of choosing one particular option over another. So finding these win-win spaces where all can come together, and if not find win-win solutions, at least find reasonably bargained outcomes which satisfy some of the many concerns that we've highlighted in this report. The beginnings of this are again a combination of how we behave, how incentives and regulations work, and how government lays out the big context, the big pathway on which the big stage on which some of this plays out. And we international organizations also have a role, because so much of it is now beyond and one government's footprint.
That's right.
The COVID crisis showed it quickly spilled out all over the world, and some common parameters of global governance had to be agreed on. How you travel between countries, how supply chains interact, and now it's happening with the vaccine. Some protocols are being put together. Who gets the vaccine when?
Yeah.
By what criteria, how is it managed, etc. Again, a lot of international cooperation is required for this to happen. That's where our agencies have a role to play.
Okay, and I hope you found that crystal ball of yours, because I think, you know, one of the things that UNDP is saying that is that we could be the first generation to right this wrong. Your hopes for the future, Niloy?
Yes, I think, as our administrator says in his foreword, we are the first generation to recognize it. We haven't started it. We didn't start the fire. It was always burning. But it has accelerated. Let's just say that we are the first generation to recognize it. And therefore, given the fact that human beings are capable of so much, we are also capable of fixing this. So that's why, but it requires a massive, unprecedented effort and thinking differently outside the box and thinking in more complex systems rather than linear solutions for one thing or another. My hope for the future is it's green. The future is bright, it's green.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Niloy Banerjee, who is the resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam for the United Nations Development Programme. And we were discussing the Human Development Report of 2020, which kind of outlines the fact that people and the planet are on a collision course. And, unless we take some bold new steps, things aren't going to get right. So like Niloy said, it takes some unprecedented steps and some unprecedented working together between all countries to fix the problems that we've actually created, that we humans have created for the world. And if you'd like to find out more about that report, all you need to do is head to hdr.undp.org. Thank you again, Niloy, for joining me today.
Thank you, Juliet. Lovely talking to you.
If you missed any part of today's interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can always search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You can also find us on Google Podcasts and Apple Podcasts. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.